Welcome to Music A to Z. Thank you for joining us. I am Steve Ferguson.
I am Douglas Ferguson.
How are you doing, Doug?
You know, I was a little I was playing Super Mario Bros. 3, and then you called me up, and I was like, oh, I guess I should go record that podcast. No, I'm just joking. I'm actually looking forward to this episode quite a bit.
Yeah.
But I was actually playing Super Mario Bros. 3.
We had a hard time getting together within the last... within the last few weeks.
Well, we made it last week.
We made it last week, but before then, we were just having...
a couple weeks. But at the same time, the audience isn't going to know the difference.
No.
Because we only just started... we just got the website up.
Yeah, so we have a backlog of episodes, which is good because it gives us a buffer.
As we are recording this, the only episode out is the A for Arcade Fire.
Yeah, so we've just gone live now. The website is fairly basic, but I'm totally fine with that. I just want this... want this up and going. I can edit it in my spare time.
I really like, I've never perused through a podcast website before. Yeah. I just subscribe on iTunes typically. So we're kind of expecting that to happen with everyone else.
I'm actually just hoping that it's just flashy enough to get people's attention so that they're interested, then they subscribe, and then they don't have to go back to the website again. Yeah. Unless they really want to read the little blip summaries we're going to have with each episode.
Okay.
Like, this week, Steve and Doug talk about Arcade Fire.
They're like, yes, yeah. Oh, I was just wondering that why it was called A for Arcade Fire. No, that all makes sense now. All right, I'm ready.
Yeah, so really excited about the website. I should also mention that we have cover art for our podcast now, so the timing is excellent for this. I was pursuing a professionally done photograph. It's a woman holding a pair of headphones and a little light showing between the ear pieces. I had to go through the photographer who then sent me to this company that holds the rights in the UK, and they asked, I love this, this is hilarious. They said, okay, well, you know, we'll see about hooking you up. It's just what's in your budget? And I said, well, I don't really have much of a budget, but I have no problem pimping you guys out. I have no problem saying, here's the photographer, here's the company that holds the rights, they're awesome, go check out their other stuff at X website. And then they get back to me like the next day and they're like, yeah, well, let's say you have the rights for 2 to 3 years. How much are you looking to spend? And I'm like, how about 50 Canadian dollars, like a year, but like paid once a year. So I don't spend 150 up front. I think that's basically the most that I could afford. Then they never got back to me.
Like, we're kind of hoping for somewhere in the vicinity of $45,000.
Well, you know, you have to ask. I understand that there, like, for photographers, there is an initial investment cost. I mean, we have a friend who's a photographer, and she spent a lot of money on photographs, or on photography equipment. But, I mean, it does beg the question. It's like, what is a single photo worth? Can you put a monetary value on it?
Also, you said it wasn't the photographer. You said it was some company.
Well, yeah, she basically has this company who managed the rights, who try to determine what's fair and stuff like that. It's not a job that I would envy. I don't know, but it was kind of too bad that they just kind of focused on the money aspect and then stopped talking to me, straight up.
You know, let's be a little more civil.
Yeah, it's to say, well, we're kind of hoping towards X amount. Let's negotiate, let's talk. I'm not wanting to use her entire catalog, just a single photograph. But oh well.
Anyway, I mean, the fact that you're willing to pay anything, I thought was really nice. Yeah. I mean, we could have just taken the photo
and see how long we could have gone with it. Yeah.
but we're more honest than that.
But instead, my wife made a picture instead of my son when he was young with my huge clamshell headphones, and she spruced it up, and I think it looks rather dapper.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I see. Yeah, I thought the picture looked familiar. I'm like, I think I know that baby.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool.
It's actually, coincidentally, kind of a parallel photograph of myself. I had a photo taken of me when I was very young wearing our dad's headphones. So I think that's kind of a nice unifying concept in that, you know, music can go from generation to generation. It kind of affects us maybe all the same on some level, or maybe it's a bit different.
Yeah.
But it still has an effect, I think.
But we should probably get on onto our subject because we're almost 5 minutes in already.
Indeed. Yeah.
So we're on F.
We are on F this week. We hope you guys enjoyed the F65 episode. Ooh, what this band week, did we decide
we're going on? We're going in a different direction, a little less a little more scatterbrained and all over the place. We're going to go with the Flaming Lips. You got that right. You know that it is.
Yeah.
them know you realize that life goes fast. It's hard to make the good things last. You realize the sun done go down. It's just an illusion caused by the world spinning round.
Doug, I got a question for you.
Yes.
Do you realize you have the most beautiful face?
Well, I guess my retort is, do you realize that happiness makes you cry?
Ah, excellent. Good retort. Flaming Lips are a band who have been skirting just beneath pop culture, I would say. They keep turning up everywhere. They were in the SpongeBob SquarePants movie when HMV was releasing their album. At War with the Mystics, they had a lot of advertising up, so I feel like there is a dedicated fan base, but they never seem to quite punch in through, like, the top 10 list.
People who like music a lot know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
People who are kind of just listen to Top 40 do not.
Yeah.
They're right at that edge. Like, they're beyond indie.
Indeed, they're signed to one of the biggest labels.
Warner Brothers, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's why some of their stuff is hard to find on YouTube, because for whatever reason, Warner Brothers hates YouTube.
They really do, though.
Like, oh, YouTube, all people want to watch music videos? Who wants to do that?
You want to
watch our music videos? You buy it off iTunes.
You'll even see labels like EMI, who don't have as big a deal as Warner Brothers does. Like, Time Warner, they're on top of that.
Yeah, oh man. That's why when we were making films and we were doing, like, really small things, so we just used, like, whatever music we came across, we even knew then not to use any Flaming Lips, because, like, Warner Brothers is going to find this and they're going to take it down. Even though, like, we are the smallest film crew in the world and we mean no threat to them whatsoever, they're going to hunt us and destroy us. How did we come across
them? I can tell you how we came across
them. I'm actually really having a tough time. Oh, wait.
It was
you showed was me. Yeah. So you're
the what happened was story. Our friend Travis, and who we've mentioned on the show before, introduced me, perhaps both of us, to a song called Tides of the Moon by Mercury Rev.
He sent that to me.
He sent that to you, okay.
And then I showed you it, and you liked it a lot.
It's a good song off of a really
good album.
Yeah, off of a really good album.
But we can talk about Mercury Rev there are connections between Mercury Rev and...
There's actually very significant connections between Mercury Rev and Flaming Lips. Well, needless to say, anyways, I had purchased the album over Amazon, and at the time, 2002, 2003... Remember, no Wikipedia, not a lot of Bandcamp and CD Baby. These sites just didn't exist.
Well, actually, CD Baby did, but it's been around for quite a while, I think. But it's changed a lot since then, and it isn't what it is. It wasn't what it is now, for sure.
So I actually got a lot of my music recommendations at the time from Amazon. Like, Amazon had this feature, they probably still do, I don't use it anymore, where they said, hey, we noticed you purchased this CD and this CD. Here are related artists you might like also. And from Mercury Rev, they linked me to Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots by the Flaming Lips. That title alone, I was just, it immediately caught my attention. I was like, Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots by the Flaming Lips? What?
Like, how trippy could this be?
Yeah, from there, I took a look. Hey, the cover art, awesome. I sampled some of the songs, and they sounded really kind of funny and really kind of cool. And so I ordered that from Amazon. Amazon, of course, absolutely delighted. I'm sure their software was reaffirmed on that day. And at first, I found the album to be quite a novelty and quite funny. But then, this is the thing about the Flaming Lips. From that point on, I was able to see a lot of the interestingly heartfelt lyrics. I know it's strange to think heartfelt lyrics in Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots, but I soon became enamored with the song Ego Tripping at the Gates of Hell.
You know, that is a thing, is that, like, one of the things that what does work about the Flaming Lips is that there's this inherent quirkiness to their songwriting style that could be dismissed as something that's superficial, but they make sure it's not superficial. They make sure that there's this sort of really interesting key emotional elements to the songs, even if they're about a ridiculous subject like a Japanese girl who's trying to save the world from robots. But there's still something kind of real within that.
They're not unique in this, for sure. I felt a similar thing about Peter Gabriel's fourth album, which in the U.S. was known as Security, with a very silly sounding song, Shock the Monkey, which actually opened the doors to some very dark material. You know, if you just hear that song out of context or whatever, Shock the Monkey, that sounds funny.
I remember just thinking it was kind of a goofy song at first. But, and so I liked it, and then I didn't really like it, because I sort of, like, shrugged off the superficialness and, like, there's not much to it. And then I start to like it again because of this sort of interesting, like, dark societal commentary that it's making, and also just, like, the songwriting itself is very... It has this sort of bizarre complexity to it.
And I also felt the same way about Supertramp's Breakfast in America, because it sounds kind of silly, but... Again, heavy, heavy, heavy societal commentary. Some very, very introspective stuff. And you will find plenty of that with the Flaming Lips. I think from that point on, I think you got into Soft Bulletin first. You sent me songs from Soft Bulletin.
Yeah, yeah. I think, actually, let me look that up. I remember it was a, there was some specific songs that I...
Soft Bulletin was the album immediately before Yoshimi Battles the Band of Robots. It is probably, I think, their most critically well-received album.
Soft Bulletin?
Yeah.
I think so. It was definitely what sort of... That and Yoshimi were what the closest they ever got to mainstream appeal.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the critically they were, like, set on fire, like, to be quite well, to be recognized to what they're where they are right now.
I think you definitely sent me The Observer, this dark instrumental piece. Oh, dark, dark, dark song.
Waiting for Superman? Did I?
I think that so. Might have been one of them. Yeah,
and the Spider Bite song.
Yeah, which I didn't really dig,
but I did. I do. I do like the Spider Bite
song. I like it to a point. Although his vocals, Wayne Coyne's vocals can be a bit difficult because I mean he's the guy doesn't auto tune. He doesn't process his voice. He just goes in and he's like, yeah, this takes fine, and he goes with it. Which, you know what? Okay. Okay, most of the time it works just fine. Sometimes it can be a little, is that guy off key? You know, and never will I ever say that they're fake or overproduced or not honest. When he goes in and he's singing a lyric and he's like, he's really feeling it, 9 times out of 10, that's the one he's going to do. This is a band, by the way, that, and I have seen this, they do their own sound checks before their shows.
Yeah, that was interesting. Wayne Coyne would just go up on stage. This was at Sasquatch too,
mm-hmm,
wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so this was Sasquatch, I think 2007 or 2008?
7 or 8. Maybe 8.
I think it might be 2008.
Yeah.
I know it was the Sasquatch before Obama got elected, because I remember that he was promoting. He was big thumbs up. So I think it was 2007 then.
Well, it could have been 2008, because the election's in November 2008. Sasquatch was in May.
2008. There you go. I think it was 2008. Yeah, he would just go up on the stage and he started banging his own gong and strumming his own things. And we're like, why is he doing the sound check? I've never seen a band do their own sound check. It's almost kind of humbling. It's almost like he wants to have like more control over the live show and to sort of just be sort of kind of real with it. I don't know. I'm not really. I guess I don't really know his motivations, but it is interesting though.
I think it was the Spider Bite song, sorry, that you sent me. Yeah. So I was kind of on the fence about getting that album, but I did wind up getting it. And
I think I remember where it's sort of like you. I think you listened to it once and you're just like, I don't know if it's for me. And then I kind of was like, you know, I think you need to give it another try because
you say that to me a lot. You know, and 9 times out of 10, you're right.
Where it's just sort of one of those cases where. It can be a bit of a slow burner. Like I find this with a few albums, not necessarily by just the Flaming Lips, but with a lot of bands, where kind of the first time through, there's a certain mood and style and tone within the album, and so it does to some degree sound a little redundant. But you kind of need to listen to it more than once so the songs can find their own identity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is the Soft Bulletin is one of those. We're sort of like, yeah, you know, actually, there's a lot that this album does have to offer, and. And I can sort of see why it got such critical praise when it came out in, what was it, 1999? I think so.
Yeah, that sounds right. Let's take a, before we continue on, because then from this point on, our history with the band kind of matches their own history.
Yeah.
Let's step back to 1983, when the Flaming Lips formed. I'm not sure who, this is the part of the problem, is that they've had so many members who have just kind of like floated in and floated out.
Well, in the early years, I guess.
Yeah, especially in the early years. I can tell you they're from Oklahoma City, and Oklahoma City loves the Flaming Lips. They have like Flaming Lips Day and stuff down there. They did, I think, a huge charity thing for the Oklahoma City bombings that really ingrained them into the public awareness down there. So, I mean, they are absolutely darlings of Oklahoma City. In Norman, Oklahoma, Wayne Coyne, and he was on guitar and he's... Oh, that's interesting. He was just on guitar. His brother Mark sang the lead vocals. This guy Michael Ivins on bass guitar. Needless to say, very much like most bands starting out, they kind of switched musicians around, tried different things. Mark Coyne eventually dropped out. I don't know what the hell he's doing these days. But they released their first album in 1986, a full three years after.
What is it? Here, you can hear it? Or no, what's it called? Here it is.
Here it is?
With here as in like with your ear. Here it is.
That's right. Yeah, in 1986. But then they were very productive. They had, oh my God, the Flaming Lips in 1987.
I didn't realize that you were, I thought you were genuine surprised. Like, oh, did they come up with four albums in a year or something?
No, Telepathic Surgery, In a Priest-Driven Ambulance.
Oh, God, G-A-W-D.
Yeah, G-A-W-D, God.
That's before, I think, that kind of, oh God, was popularized. I think maybe they're pioneers in that spelling of God.
In around this time, they had Jonathan Donahue playing with them. He did some guitar work with them, but he decided to go off and form Mercury Rev not long after. He and I can't remember the name of the big guy who was singing half the vocals in their early years. The guy who left right before Mercury Rev actually really started to take off. I don't remember his name. But they basically did Mercury Rev. And you can definitely hear some similarities, but I think it was actually good for both of them, for Donahue to have left, because it allowed them to explore their own sounds differently. And achieve, Mercury Rev had some success.
You have to kind of wonder, they had success in the late 90s and early 2000s as well. I have to kind of wonder, what if they did stay together? Like, what would that sound like?
I think it would be a very, very different sounding band.
I mean, I appreciate this universe in which the Flaming Lips and Mercury Rev exist separately, but I wonder, like, in the universe where they're one.
I can think we can safely say that they'd be a lot darker.
Probably.
Jonathan's lyrics tend to be very, very angst-filled. Even on some of the more upbeat songs, like, is it called Butterfly's Wings? Off of Secret Migration, was one of their big singles.
Oh yeah.
Even that one, which sounds kind of uplifting, it has some really, really, really sad comment behind it. But yeah, no, where Flaming Lips are considerably, well, I want to say happier, a little more joyful, with the possible exception of the most recent release. But we'll get to that. So, anyways, now. The other person to mention in regards to all this is Dave Friedman. Dave Friedman is the guitarist for Mercury Rev, and he also produces the Flaming Lips albums.
Yeah, and I think he's... I'm trying to think what else he's produced. I've seen his name in a few things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Jesus, he's worked with lots. He worked with Weezer, Neon Indian, Wolfgang.
Neon Indian, I think that's where I heard his name recently.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Sparkle MGMT, Horse, I see. Mogwai. Yes, definitely MGMT. Okay, clap go. Your hands, say yeah, okay, go. Yeah,
Tame Impala.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's another one.
Yeah, that's definitely right.
Tame Impala. David Friedman, he's a good producer. I mean, just from that sort of sample of the stuff he works on, it's usually pretty interesting stuff.
Would you consider him the heir apparent to Brian Eno?
You know, I don't know. It's kind of hard to compare Brian Eno to anybody. He's just kind of... And what does Brian Eno even do? Like, if you listen to the bands he works with, they're all so different.
I feel that he brings an ambient atmosphere, that he likes having layered sounds underneath.
I just think that what I mean by that is just really that it seems like he's very adaptable to
working with.
And so
I tend to think of the difference between U2's War and U2's Unforgettable Fire, even though it spanned a couple years difference.
Well, even between Unforgettable Fire, which he worked on, as well as Joshua Tree, those are two radically different sounds and albums as well, right? So
early U2 just sounds so much more raw, like in a garage, whereas that stuff sounds like it was crafted in the...
I guess, well, like we said about Brian Eno for sure, is that he definitely lends a degree of polished professionalism to a recording. Even Coldplay's Xylo Miloto, there's that... I mean, I'm not actually too fond of the album as a whole. I do like parts of it, but there is this really kind of chic glossiness to it that I think that Eno is partially responsible for in his ability to just kind of like make something sound really smooth and really good and
needless to say, even just going through that list, I already have an enormous amount of respect for Dave Friedman. It must be hard though, because like a lot of these albums of bands, this is within a relatively short amount of time, this is within like a decade and stuff. So he's a busy fellow. Back to the Flaming Lips, early, early stuff. They were just kind of on and off, and right.
They had a, where is it in their discography? Oh, Transmissions is actually fairly deep in there.
Yeah, that's the thing. Transmissions from the Satellite Heart had
their big hit.
Their big hit, which got them a lot of MTV play.
You know, that's the thing is that even for the Flaming Lips, that's a really unusual song. She Don't Use Jelly, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is right when Jonathan Donahue left, ironically.
Okay. See, and, is that how it goes? Somebody.
And this is when Steven Droist came in, who is their drummer now, who has been a lifelong member.
So, She Don't Use Jelly is, now this is one of those cases where the lyrics are really odd and quirky,
yeah.
But don't necessarily have that depth to them, which is perhaps why people started to kind of, like, not pay too much attention to them after that.
I saw one reviewer say that the lyrics were Dadaist. Dada is a unconventional art form where anything goes, and I think...
Da-da-da.
I think that that the reviewer is just being kind of nice. He's like, oh, they're so artistic that even their nonsense songs is art. Was basically what they were saying.
I think it was, personally, like, I don't mind the song. I like it. It's fun. But I just, like, think that they were just being kind of goofy.
And you know what? There's nothing wrong with that. Have a goofy song every once in a while.
But, yeah, I mean, it's definitely not my favorite. And it's not even my favorite off the album.
Oh, yeah. Doug actually, because we had heard it.
Travis lent me the CD.
No, actually, I hadn't even heard that point. And then either you or Travis sent me Pilot Can at the Queer of God, which... As a title, makes no sense.
No.
And that song is amazing.
That's a great song. That's a good song. And it's sort of like not what you do. If you listen to sort of modern Flaming Lips, it's very different than that kind. That it's very rock, but it's got, it's playful, but at the same time, kind of edgy at the same time. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I don't begrudge You Don't Use Jelly. Apparently had a very kind of... The song is about this chick who's really kind of weird, and instead of putting jam on her toast, she puts... Vaseline.
Yeah. It's also got about a guy who blows his nose with magazines.
Yeah.
And a girl who dyes her hair with tangerines. So that's essentially what the song is about. Yeah. I really feel like I should have given a spoiler warning before saying that. Transmissions, I think, it's an unusual album. It's kind of uneven. The high points are pretty high.
Very uneven.
And the low points are kind of like, you know, and there's nothing I think I hate off of it. Mm-mm. But there's some parts where I just like, I'm not too into it. Be My Head, I really enjoy. And
Turn It On, I think, is a great opening track.
Turn It On and Pilot Can and the Queer God, those would be my...
And I think Slow Nerve Action is a great closing track.
Okay.
So, I mean, it starts well and it ends well, but it does get kind of lost. It's worth noting they were already signed to Warner Brothers by this point. There is a little confusion as to when they were signed on to Warner Brothers. I don't know why. But because a lot of people equate, well, they had a hit, so Warner Brothers scooped them up then. That's not actually true. Warner Brothers had scooped them up earlier. They were signed in 90 to Warner Brothers. So my guess is the grunge rock thing was just kind of starting. And Warner Brothers, being smart, was like, okay, who can we scoop up that kind of fits this kind of mold? And Flaming Lips actually really kind of... sound like part of that.
It's part of that movement.
Yeah, part of that movement. And of course, then when She Don't Use Jelly really took off, then Warner Bros. Is just fine with them.
And they're like, you got a hit. You sold some albums. We like you.
And their output was good enough that they were constantly releasing stuff. One of their earlier singles on Warner Bros. Was, I think it's called Shine On Sweet Jesus. And it's just an unusual song. Wayne Coyne was fascinated. He's not a religious fellow, but he was very fascinated with the concept of religion. And this is off of In a Priest-Driven Ambulance, I believe. And you listen to it, and you have to wonder what the hell is going on. And I will tell you what the hell is going on. Drugs.
Okay.
No joke, drugs. One of their albums has a picture of an eyeball up close that is all dilated. And that's one of the members, I can't remember which, he was on LSD and they took a picture of his eye and said, let's put this on the back. These guys will... be the first to admit that they use drugs and the drugs help them with the music.
Personally, I don't necessarily feel that in order to achieve great music and to be creative, you need drugs. But same time, I think that a lot of the Beatles' more interesting stuff came out of their sort of more drug-induced era.
And I think it is worth mentioning the Spider Bite song. Spider Bite song, Going Forward in Time Again, was from Soft Bulletin. And initially... the song was allegedly about who was it? Was it maybe Steve Droitz who had this spider bite that became really infected?
Yeah, and then they were really badly infected, and then they were actually considering like amputation or something mm-hmm. like that. But then it wound up not happening, which is good.
And it wound up not being a spider bite. It wound up being due to drug use, due to heroin that injection.
That kind of spider bite.
Yeah, okay. Whoops. The sweetest venom of
you
them
know what
all.
Actually though, that almost I didn't know that, but that almost like makes me have a little more respect for the song. Him singing like I'm so glad that it didn't destroy you.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is kind of poetic. That it's sort of like, and the thing is that the song is not accusatory in any way.
It isn't. No, there is no judgment. It is more along like if it destroyed you, it would destroy me.
It's actually that actually kind of makes it a much sadder, more in depth, deep song to me. I'm kind of glad I just learned that.
Anyway, so I purchased somewhat recently, I guess within the last year, Clouds Taste Metallic, which was the follow-up to Transmissions from the Satellite Heart.
I was supposed to listen to it, but I have not, because Steve didn't let me this time.
I forgot, and to be honest, that is in general, what's happened, because I find the album mediocre. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's fairly mediocre. It's just it's not what I was expecting, because I was very curious to hear it's the one album that is between
Transmissions
and Zarika, and I was like, I'm very very curious to as to how this sounds. I mean, I don't really have a lot of comments about Clouds Taste Metallic, to be honest. I'm sorry, but I think now we should cover Zarika.
the logical progression takes us there.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, this I have to say about Zarika. Whether or not you appreciate the songwriting in it,
mm-hmm.
it's one of the most unique album experiences you will ever have. The concept is that it's only a handful of tracks. Like, it's, what, seven or eight tracks?
That sounds about right.
Some longer than others, but they're not recorded and produced normally. They're on four different CDs, because again, this is like during the age of CDs.
Mm-hmm.
Four different CDs. Each one contains a part of the song. As in, I mean, it's kind of hard to even explain, but like, it's just like different. Not necessarily that there's blank spots, although there are some blank spots in certain songs,
mm-hmm.
but different like elements and layers per CD. So, in order to actually get the full song, you need to play it simultaneously on four different stereos.
Ideally, in different parts of the room.
Yes.
And if you're playing the song and you get up and you start walking around the room, the way the song sounds will change because mm-hmm. you're changing the emphasis just by moving around the room.
Steve and I have done Zarika parties mm-hmm. Several times, and I recommend that anyone who is really enthusiastic about music, I really think anyone should try it out, because it's... Then you know you can find copies of it around.
Yeah.
So it's not like this is a super rare album. And in fact, they actually did a vinyl re-release a couple years ago. But yeah, it's fascinating just to like, if you walk around a room, the soundscape of the song changes into something different.
It came about because they were on drugs and they were doing something called the parking lot experiments, where they would get a bunch of cars in a parking lot, like a ton. And they would have on tape cassettes, they would have different stuff they'd recorded, but different stuff. And then they would play them out of sync, they would play them in sync, probably while sitting back and saying, "Whoa, man." And they'd drive the cars around while this was happening and just create an interesting sonic experiment. And they said, "Well, how can we duplicate this on CD?" And they're like, "Well, clearly we can't have like 20 odd CDs to play like seven tracks simultaneously." So I think initially they were going to go to six, but I think they were talked down to four.
Oh, yeah, the label wasn't happy about this.
Warner Brothers was furious.
They're like, no one's going to buy this.
No one is going to buy this. You guys are crazy. It's actually amazing. You know, they said, no, it's absolutely not happening. We're not going to release this. And Flaming Lips said, okay, well, look, tell you what. If we go to our website, back when the internet was all...
It's all like, hey, guys, check it out. We have a website.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this was, what, 97?
Yeah.
So pre-YouTube.
So actually, in this case, probably more like 96, because they were
trying to
get the album made.
They said, hey, look, we're accepting pre-orders for this album. We're not going to lie to you. Here's what the album is.
Yeah.
Here's the whole thing.
Why would you try and butter something like that up?
We need X number of pre-sales to convince the label to make this album. And they got it. And the fans said, All right. And and absolutely. And then, and so Flaming Lips said, hey, look, here are the number of pre-orders. That is enough to cover the costs of printing the album. Warner Brothers was still not happy because they're like, okay, you've got your fan base to support it, but no one else is going to buy it. You're not going to attract a new audience with this. It's too experimental. It's crazy. And it's not like we're talking about gentle acoustic pieces as well. There's even a warning label in the album saying, hey, there's some high-pitched frequencies in here that may cause you to have a headache. You know, these are unorthodox sounds.
And admittedly, like, not everything on Zarika is amazing to listen to.
Yeah.
But there are some really cool songs.
There are some really cool songs. So Warner Brothers said, okay, look, here's the deal. We are going to print this album for you, and we're going to do all that, but it is not going to count as one of the releases in your contract. So that means that you have to, because, you know, when they sign to a label, you have to give X number of albums released under that label. Warner Brothers is saying this is not going to count. You're going to owe us still one more album past that.
But I guess the Flaming Lips must have really wanted to do it, so.
And
good, I'll power.
And they said, we want to see progress on your next album already. And sure enough, they sent Warner Bros. A few songs for what would be released as a soft bulletin. Warner Bros. Said, okay, that's more in line with what we expect. Probably easy tracks like Waiting for Superman or something, you know, probably ones that would appease Warner Brothers. I don't know for sure which ones they sent along to Warner Bros., but they did send them a couple. But yeah, Zarika now has cult notoriety.
I mean, how can you not? Like, once you sort of even know what that album is, you don't forget it.
Yeah.
You know, that seems to me like a good long-term investment in fans.
The first time I heard about this album, we were at their concert. I think that was the one I missed the opening act.
Oh, right. In 2007, we went to see Flaming Lips, and Steve couldn't get out of work. Or no, didn't you, like... I think it was something really, like, really unfortunate. Like, you got the shift off, but then they denied it or something?
No,
or?
What had happened is that I agreed to work the matinee.
Right.
And the concert was at like 7 or 7:30 or even 8. And my shift was done at 6. And I was like, this is fine. This is loads of time. And the two managers who shall go nameless, they were coming back from a meeting and they decided to like stop and get dinner first or whatever, knowing I had booked the evening off for a concert. And they delayed things and they came back late. And by that point, because they'd come back late, there were a couple things I needed to finish. Because, I mean, I can't just sit on my laurels and wait for them to come back. I have to do work. And so I was pretty angry. And apparently I missed an amazing live show from the opening act.
The opening act was Black Moth Super Rainbow.
Which is right up the Flaming Lips alley.
Yeah, which it totally makes sense as an opening act for the Flaming Lips. And that was a great, great... I don't want
to
rub it in.
I listened to the album and I was like... Hey, this is a really good album. And Doug, Jessica, and Travis were like, it's okay. It's just nothing compared to the live show. And they weren't saying it to be mean. Mm-hmm. They legitimately loved the live show.
I came to appreciate the album more. I guess perhaps as the live show got a little more distant. But I would love to see those guys live again.
I would love to see those guys live. So they played Riding to Work in 2025, You're Invisible Now. The strangely misspelt You're Invisible Now. They played that, and Wayne Coyne introduced the song by saying that, 2025.
Mm.
He introduced the song saying that whenever he thinks of the song, he imagines that, what's it, Van Gogh? Or is it Picasso painting Scream? The person on the dock holding their face screaming as everything's distorted. And then he played it, and in the background, they were playing clips from THX 1130? I'm having a tough time with
1135. THX
1135. Okay. Well, I was there playing clips of that in the background. And I, to this day, love that song. That's a great song. Goes through several movements. Just astounding. I went to look it up on YouTube. I found that it was on Zarika. And I found that there was a fan-made DVD for Zarika where somebody basically combined all the components into basically one stereo track. And then set them to themed videos. The one for Riding to Work in 2025 is a science fiction collage of famous science fiction movies. And works really, really well. And then I also found the other track that I love off that album, March of the Rotten Vegetables, which in this fan DVD is set to anime, clips from famous anime movies. Also an amazing, amazing song with a kick-ass drum solo halfway through.
What I appreciate is that the Flaming Lips have released a few of the Zarika songs, a stereo mix of them, as soft bulletin B-sides. So you can find some of those ones on iTunes. If you
if you don't want to like invest in the Zurika package, there's a few of the highlights that you can pick up for whatever 99 cents.
I'll just say straight up, if you are a fan of music and experimental music, you know, just kind of looking for something kind of interesting. That is, it's pretty worthwhile
investment. It definitely is. Zurika is a good. I mean, just to experience it, I think you should. I mean,
you don't even need to play all four CDs at once. You can play two at a time or three at a time.
But Zurika met with very, very mixed reviews, if I recall. Yes. Like polarized reviews when it came out. In that, I do remember that there was one. I don't remember which music magazine it was. But they lambasted it, and they gave it they hardly ever gave that mark of 0 out of 10, but they just hated it. And then conversely, the same reviewer who hated Zurika so much gave Soft Bolton the similarly very rare score of a full 10 out of 10 because he loved the Soft Bolton so much. So
Pitchfork Media.
What's great about
is Pitchfork Media, yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah, so it's Pitchfork.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's something to be said for... What's great about the Flaming Lips is that if you don't like one album, you might like the next one.
Oh, yeah,
because, absolutely. Because they're all really different, so... Especially in their later years. I guess Zurika and Beyond. I feel that Zurika was one of their landmark albums in that mm-hmm. it did kind of reinvent their sound.
I'd say, just based on Cloud Stays Metallic to Zurika... A complete reinvention right there.
Yeah.
I think, again, the introduction of Steve Droist and the loss of Jonathan Donahue began that process, and then the Parking Lot Experiments kind of set it really in motion.
And so I think that to me is when they got to be really interesting and really had like a new bar set for what kind of music they would make. And then the Soft Bolton was definitely exemplary title in their catalog. I think we already have talked about that one fair bit, though.
Yeah, and we talked about Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots, which a lot of people know the song, Do You Realize?
Yeah.
That one, again, is, I think, just kind of skirts under the mainstream. People, like, you hear it occasionally in commercials and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's one of their biggest hits. Not quite top 40, but definitely charted, I think.
Yeah.
After that was... after a few like EPs, EP single things, I wore the Mystics, which is I think my personal favorite. Just there's the one from 2006.
I remember when that came out. At that point, we were pretty hyped on the Flaming Lips, and now that we're starting to feel kind of caught up on this band, you know, hey, new release all of a sudden.
Yeah, exactly. That's always I really like that when you get into a band, you sort of catch up a little bit, and then you can experience the excitement of them coming out with a new album. So that was that War with the Mystics for us. It was the new album. And
even to this day, I think it's a really, really good album. It takes a lot of the early, like Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots is not a complicated album. It's very easy to listen to. War with the Mystics is still a really, really good album, but it's fairly more complex.
And it's really diverse. Like, it mm-hmm. covers a lot of ground. It shifts mood quite a bit. And it seems to be one of their most similar, like introspective, but also like them sort of gazing. It feels like they're almost gazing out into the stars sometimes. like they're just, right. They're looking and trying to understand the universe, and understand themselves.
And if I am not incorrect, the lead single from that, "The Wand," "The Will Always Negates Defeat," is in your top.
20? It is.
It's in the top 20 of your favorite songs?
No, not top 20, but maybe top 30. It is on my list of my 100 favorite songs. The Wand is, I think, an outstanding track. Yeah, that one. And they also had the Yeah 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 song was also a big single for them.
Yeah, single.
Actually, that one's very one of my favorite music videos.
It's great music video, werewolf running around. And,
yeah, oh man, makes me laugh.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's performed as well as Yoshimi.
No, I don't think so.
But man, those songs sounded good live too.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yes. I definitely wanted to mention the live shows are always worth it and always good.
Oh yeah, they are one of the acts you should see live, and we've seen them live twice.
I've seen them live three times.
I've seen them live twice. All right, I think I turned down seeing. I think probably just due to money constraints and feeling like, well, I have already seen them twice. Mm-hmm. I think I can wait a little while longer until I'm a little more financially stable.
This is a band that I really dig because they honestly believe in talking to the audience and connecting to the audience. and saying, hey guys, how are you doing? They even, I can't remember which concert it was, but it was here in Vancouver at the Malkin Bowl, where they said, you know what, we were going to have the stage in because it was forecast for rain, but I said, you know what, I want to be able to come out and to talk to the audience. So I said, no, extend the stage regardless if there's rain or not, and it's not raining. And, you know, I mean, he was legitimately talking to us, you know, he legitimately wants to connect with the audience. Plus, they had dancing Santa Clauses and dancing Martians on stage.
And they also, at different points, have dancing Teletubbies.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, like, they go for a real bizarre experience every time.
We should mention their performance at Sasquatch, the one that Travis was in the midst of walking out of.
Did he walk out?
He was in the midst. He was going to go check out Ghostland Observatory on one of the stages.
Okay.
And then they start the song, and then you're like, oh, I think this is Travis's... I think this is a Led Zeppelin song. And then we found out later that it was actually Travis's favorite Led Zeppelin song.
The song remains the same.
Oh, okay.
Which is one of my favorites, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I almost used it for my 100 favorite songs, but I went with Trampled Underfoot instead.
Good choice.
Yeah.
And then, so they're playing the song, and then these three naked women run out onto stage.
No, it was way more than three. There was like six of them.
Six? Are you sure?
Hey, I remember. Okay. I remember because I was quite fascinated that each one of them had like sort of different pubic hair treatment. So these six naked women come out, and like some of them have their full pubic hair. Some of them like a landing strip. One maybe have had a star, and I'm like, wow, you can do all kinds of interesting things with pubic hair. This is really fascinating, and also kind of sexy.
Yeah, and they're surrounding Wayne Coyne.
Yeah, they're just dancing around and dancing, and he's just singing the song. You can tell though, like. It was a bit distracting for him, yeah.
and then when they leave off the stage, you know, he starts to talk, then he stops and just kind of, like, looks away and laughs a bit. I don't think he knew it was going to happen.
No, it did seem kind of like a surprise.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was a very human moment where he just sort of was, like, just kind of taken aback. I don't know who orchestrated the naked girls, but... and I think there was someone at, like, around us at this concert who was like, is this legal?
yeah, that's true.
And to which I still don't know if it is.
I have no idea. I don't know Washington
State
laws.
It is a private event. You need to have tickets for it.
That's true.
But it is a all ages.
It is all ages, though.
So,
yeah. If anyone lives in Washington State and is familiar with such things, please drop us a line. let us know
if, because when we want to hold a concert, we want to know if public full frontal nudity is perfectly acceptable or not.
I do also want to mention that whenever he starts the show, he starts off in a giant inflatable ball that he rolls around the audience. So the audience lifts him up.
First, they descend in a spaceship.
Right.
Not, of course.
My bad. I forgot.
Spoiler alert: it's not a real spaceship, but it's the closest thing you're going to get in a live performance. I've also heard of them in more recent shows exiting out of a vagina.
Yes. No, that is 100% correct. The last show that I saw them at,
they didn't come into the spaceship.
No, they came out of a giant set. Well, it was a screen.
A screen.
And it was like, it was a sort of a trippy, multicolored, but very clearly woman's legs, and then they walk out through the screen.
The new reborn Flaming Lips.
There you go.
What I also like about the Flaming Lips there's so much to cover.
There is a lot to cover.
This is a long episode, so bear with us. Is that they're also fanboys.
Oh, yes.
They love music. And this shows in the... Because between studio albums, they've released a number of tribute albums.
Yes.
One of which is The Dark Side of the Moon. They teamed up with, the White Dwarves or whatever?
Something in White Dwarf.
It's like Wayne Coyne's nephew. Yeah. His nephew's band.
Stardust and White Dwarf?
Something like that. They did a Dark Side of the Moon tribute album. And it's no Dark Side of the Moon. In that it's not going to be as good as the Pink Floyd one, but it is actually pretty good.
I'm not so pretentious when it comes to music to think that no album can be covered. If someone wants to cover a Beatles album, I will say, let it be. I'll say, all right, go for it. I want to hear what you bring to the table. If it's going to sound just like the Beatles, you're wasting my time. If it's going to just be mocking and be stupid and sound awful, then no, I don't want to hear it. But if you're bringing something new and interesting and paying homage... Okay, I'm going to listen to what you have.
And I think that there really is a lot of the Flaming Lips in that version of Dark Side of the Moon. They definitely kind of made it their own, but also stayed really true to the material. They also did one, they teamed up with a bunch of different bands, a handful of them, where they did In the Court of the Crimson King by King Crimson. I only listened to that once through. I remember...
Star Death and White Dwarfs.
Star Death and White Dwarfs, yes, okay. I remember liking it, not loving it, but I think I should give it another chance. I feel like it's sort of one of those cases where it's, you don't necessarily want to just go by one listening.
Yeah, they also did the Flaming... Oh, no, sorry. Then we should get to Embryonic, which I believe you described as...
Well, okay, the first impression of Embryonic wasn't super positive, because I think that I was kind of hoping it'd be sort of in the vein of At War of the Mystics and the Yoshimi, but it actually was a totally radically different step. It's a lot darker, very, like, distorted bass, heavy, and percussion, and, like, it's kind of a weird album.
Mm-hmm.
I've come to appreciate it more, a lot more with time. I almost saw it as, because I reviewed it, and during my review on Sour Grapes, that's when I kind of came to appreciate it more in that moment, because I really was going to be a little lukewarm, but I wound up giving it a fairly positive review, because I heard a lot of, like, early, like, a lot of Yes and Genesis in there, so it seemed to me like it was almost like their progressive rock album.
I think it's worth mentioning that right before they released it in their media releases, they... listed their influences, like jazz and things like that.
I think they mentioned like Miles Davis.
Yeah, I don't hear any of that. I don't know why they think that. Is there a sign I'm missing? I don't know.
I mean, I know a lot of Miles Davis. Maybe a little bit from like Sketches of Spain, that kind of thing. But overall, I mean, maybe it was on their mind at the time, but I don't really hear it in the final product. But yeah, it's a very this album is very interesting, and it's really organic, and it's hard to pick out specific tracks that I can recommend. But yeah, it's one of those ones you got to kind of listen to as a whole. And even though they called it a double album, even though it comes on one CD,
mm-hmm.
probably two vinyls though. But they call it a double album, so it's a little long as well.
You can tell they're still kind of eighties children in a way, yeah. to still have terms like double album, and whereas like nowadays when we think of double album we think of Stadium Arcadium, yeah. which is like massive. It's like that's a double album.
that's a marathon. That's what that is. You know, it's not bad, but it's a lot of work.
I listened to it once. I didn't even finish it. I was just like, okay, guys, enough is enough. I get it, California. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, Embryonic. You know what was interesting about that one is that they released a... I think they have this sort of fascination with birth. Because you can tell on the front cover, there's this sort of... I mean, again, sort of a vaginal imagery, which isn't... It's not obvious. But that I think they find something kind of interesting about the process of birth and entering the world. And there's an edition of it, a limited edition, where you get it's a version that is covered in hair... Like it's like in a hairy sleeve. It's really weird. But you know, again, it's sort of what those kids. Well, you know, it's the Flaming Lips, and they'll do what they want to do.
Flaming Lips covered in hair. They did an album called Flaming Lips and Hedy Fuenz.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Which is basically them collaborating with a lot of artists.
Yeah,
I'm going to admit, I'm not a big fan. They have a track with Neon Indian on there that I was really looking forward to. That's
I really like Neon Indian.
Yeah.
The
first thing opens up with Kesha, where she's yelling at us, and the Cybermen are joining in a choir.
I kind of like that one, but I mean, just because it is memorable.
Yeah, it's memorable. That's for sure.
I mean, every time I think of it, all I think about from the whole album is "You must be upgraded." but
yeah,
it's hard to love the album. I think it's definitely one for the hardcore fans, I'd say.
There is one with, what's her face, singing a track that I thought was really, really good. Well, I'll also say that I really like Tasered and Maced, which has Aaron Barans from Ghostland Observatory telling a story. I liked that one. I thought that was kind of cool, because that actually had both flavors. It had, because Aaron from Ghostland, he's kind of an interesting fellow. And I like him, and it's a very kind of personal sort of story, and you know, you're really invested into what's going on.
See, they work with a lot of interesting people on this album too.
Yeah, Prefuse 73 and Tame Impala, Jim James and My Morning Jacket. Yeah, you know, again, I like it, but no, I mean, I like that they work with all these guys, but the end results, The first time I ever saw your face with Erykah Badu, beautiful song, a little too long, but beautiful song.
Oh, it's like 10 minutes long, yeah.
Yeah, a little too long. You could shave off, I think, half the song, you'd be okay. But, you know, I will say, though, it is very pleasing to the ear. Not the air, and the ear.
Shall we move on to The Terror?
Yes, Terror is the most recent release, came out last year.
Yeah. This is another case, kind of like Embryonic, where I think my initial listening wasn't that impressed, and then with a few more, I started to dig it a little more. But it's even darker than Embryonic is.
Yes.
I think the name of The Terror is kind of appropriate.
This is what I meant when I said earlier that if Jonathan Donahue had stayed with the band, it would be darker. This, to me, kind of sounds like what a Mercury Rev Flame and Lips hybrid album sounds like.
Well, it's kind of weird because Mercury Rev actually started to lighten up.
Hey, so, yeah, they're kind of switching places.
Yeah, Mercury Rev, they haven't released an album since 2008. But
it's been that long?
Yeah. Strange Tractor?
That was 2008?
I think so.
Ooh! Wait, when was that soundtrack they did? Bye Bye Blackbird or whatever. Hello Blackbird?
Hello Blackbird,
We'll look at a blur. Oh, well, that's depressing. Well, anyways, yeah, this is an amazingly dark album. I gave it a listen through once, and I like it. The songs are a bit too long. They tend to overstay their welcome.
Particularly You Lust.
Yes.
And there's featuring Fantagram. Oh, okay.
Yeah, well, yeah. same issue as the last album. You can barely tell.
Yeah. Which kind of shows that the contributing artists, at least, are willing to adapt to what the Flaming Lips want to achieve in their songs.
And I love Fantagram, but you can barely tell.
But You Lust, you know, that's the thing, is that I was actually just listening to that today, and I think it's one of the highlights of the album for about 7 minutes. and then after that, it's just sort of like, okay, you know, I get it.
Was that the one that has that going through the whole song?
So
that one?
I think so. Yeah. But apart from that, like, there's no other songs that are like that long. It's an interesting album. It's moody and it's atmospheric, and it, again, I think the Flaming Lips, their days of like really engaging alternative rock are over, and they're moving into some like weird experimental territory. It's definitely it's interesting to see where they're going.
Mm-hmm.
It's an ever going journey. It's
reviewer in the Georgia Strait, and this really irked me and still irks me.
Yeah,
reviewed the album, gave it a pretty high mark, and he said that despite some of the sounds and the feelings, that when he finished the album, he was left with joy. I think that guy is out of his mind. I like the album, but I think it's a concept album and has a lot to do with being cold and abandoned and losing your humanity through fear. I don't know where the hell he found joy. it was so bizarre. I read it, I was like, what are you talking about? Yeah, very, very odd. But on the whole, I will say it's a good album.
Let's talk about tracks to recommend.
Whoa. Very quickly first.
Okay.
Christmas on Mars.
Christmas on Mars. Oh, yeah.
The Flaming Lips, around the time that they were recording Yoshimi... I almost forgot. Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots. There's a song on there called Approaching Pavanus Mons by Balloon, and they had always hinted that it was originally part of the soundtrack for Christmas on Mars, which was a film that they made about Christmas on Mars.
It's Christmas on Mars.
Anyways, needless to say, they produced it, and then Warner Brothers refused to release it. And so for a long time, they were always promoting this film. And they were saying, hey, look, you know, guys, Warner Brothers won't release it. Let's just put a little pressure on, be nice about it, but, you know, let them know that there's interest. People were like, yeah. At one of the Sasquatch festivals, they held their own little screening of it there. And then finally, Warner Brothers relented, sort of. They didn't really give it a theatrical release.
I don't think so.
But they said, okay, you can release it as a DVD on the soundtrack album.
It's a good compromise.
Yeah, I think it's good. Like, we will put enough energy into it that you will have physical copies of it distributed.
And you know what? Honestly, that makes sense to me, because the audience for Christmas on Mars is gonna get it.
Yeah,
which is the Flaming Lips, the hardcore Flaming Lips fans.
Well, we watch the movie. I hold B movie nights on occasion. Not so frequently anymore. But basically, the idea is to sit down and, you know, watch some quote unquote B movies, whatever, in the broad spectrum of what I think that is. And this one was really hard to watch.
Mm-hmm.
It was just the Flaming Lips are fantastic musicians, but I just don't think they have what it takes to make film. I just don't think that they have the proper comprehension of story and structure for film.
Doug's being very, very generous right now.
I'm trying to be honest, but not
just in case they're listening.
I mean, okay, it's boring.
I'm gonna go out there, guys,
it's pretentious.
We've spent the last hour waxing praise to you guys because we love you, but it is one of the worst films I've seen in my life.
It's really rough, and the thing is, like, it just doesn't go anywhere. It just doesn't make sense. It isn't funny. It isn't clever. There's nothing to like.
If you are curious, watch the trailer. The trailer is better than the movie, and actually explains what's going on.
I'm sure there's some people who do like it.
Yeah, no, I don't want to take that away from it. If someone really digs it, I'm happy for you. I'm glad you get some joy out of it.
And again, since I'm not one to partake in narcotics, maybe that's that's part of the experience there. But you know, for a perfectly, I think I'm a very forgiving moviegoer for the most part. I mean, not to say I like everything, but I tried to be even-handed, and I appreciate the amount of work that they put into the movie. But again, I just think that like you need to have before you make any movie, you need to have a story, and I don't even know what the story of Christmas on Mars was.
Yeah, I don't want to end on a downer. So,
so it's good that you now we can talk about tracks we recommend because there's a. I love the Flaming Lips. They're one of my favorite bands.
Absolutely.
And I think that I'm going to try to limit my track recommendations one per album-ish thing. So, or do you want to recommend any first?
Yeah, because mine's probably a little shorter than yours.
Okay.
The song that I most identify with that I really, really dig and will always recommend is Ego Tripping at the Gates of Hell off of Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots. I was waiting on a moment, but the moment never came. And that can apply to so many people in so many ways, in so many contexts, but it does not change the emotion behind it. And and that song capitalizes it because it's hopeful, but acknowledges reality. And that there's so much brilliance in that song. I love that song. And you know what? I'll also go ahead... say that from the Soft Bulletin. Feeling Yourself Disintegrate is just lovely. It's just a lovely, lovely, lovely song.
And that even that statement of feeling yourself disintegrate, it sort of evokes sort of an emotion and a visual bit of imagery that to go with it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's potent in and of itself.
Yeah, I'll say Pilot Can at the Queer of God is a great, great rock track, and I guess Silver Trembling Hands off of Embryonic. Doug has a hard time narrowing it down in Embryonic. I really dig Silver Trembling Hands, and then a kind of a strange one off of an EP nonetheless, the Fight Test EP, The Strange Design of Conscience. If you can look that one up, I think you will really enjoy it. In terms of albums, if I was just going to lend someone an album as a gateway album, I'll just give them Yoshimi Battles of Pink Robots.
Yeah, off of Transmissions from Satellite Heart. I mean, Steve said Pilots Can of the Queer of God, so I'm going to say Be My Head.
There you go.
I think it's a fun one. Soft Bulletin, hard to narrow down, to be honest, but I'd say that it's, you know what, you'll like Race for the Prize.
Mm.
Just a great uplifting opening track. Just hits it out of the park.
You know, I might even link the music video to that one because I think it's possibly the best music video. I might link it in the description to this podcast on the website.
All right, cool. Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots. I will go with
One More Robot / Sympathy 3000. It's just, I don't know. It's a story about a machine who's learned to love.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful, classic sci-fi story.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. I think it's great.
And killer bass.
At War with the Mystics, on the other end of the alphabet, is, we talked about The Wand is, I think, absolutely terrific. But also, you know, I'm just going to toss another one. Why not?
And if you want to see a music video where women are having a pillow fight, jumping up and down on a bed, there you go.
Yeah, and It Overtakes Me, because I think that's an equally great song. Embryonic, let's say, you know what? I like I Can Be a Frog.
Yes.
As
with Karen O.
Is that Karen O?
That's Karen O from the Yeah Yeah Yeahs.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's something so fascinating about this song in that it's so dark musically,
mm-hmm.
but there's this curious playfulness with all the sound of the animal noises and stuff, and the lyrics themselves. It's the juxtaposition of this really like eerie song and cute kid, almost cute lyrics. In fact, they even did a version of it.
That's right.
Probably a less dark version.
It's musically far, far more silly.
Okay, yeah. In Yo Gabba Gabba.
It absolutely does.
So, so that's interesting. That's a really interesting track for me. And very memorable for those reasons. And off of The Terror, I'm going to go with the title track, which is really like dark and eerie, very well produced though.
Mm-hmm.
And
it just goes. It starts from the get go. Boom, you know exactly what to expect.
So those are my recommendations.
Good. Would you have a gateway album?
Gateway album. I think that you're gonna get some of their best stuff in At War with the Mystics.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be my thumbs up right there. Go with that one.
Cool. So thank you very much for listening.
I mean,
with a band that with this much history,
30 years.
Yeah, there was a lot of ground to cover, and we probably didn't even do the first 6 albums any justice at all. I mean, we mentioned them a bit, but. Yeah. So, I mean, do you have any comments about the Flaming Lips? Have you seen them live? If you've seen them live, you know what we're talking about. You know, do you have any feelings? Do you actually hate their guts?
Yeah, maybe.
Does Wayne Coyne look completely unhinged, as unhinged to you as he does to us?
In more recent days, he's definitely looking a little... Yeah, unhinged is the best word.
You know, what are your thoughts on the Flaming Lips? Do you have any requests for bands for us to cover? If you're thinking to yourself, they'll never know this one, we'll look them up. We'll do our research. You know, feel free to drop us a line at admin@nshgfilms.com. admin@nshgfilms.com. Now that we have our own website up, we will have another email address, probably a simpler one, but you know what? We're always checking that one too, or at least I'm always checking that one as well. So either is fine.
Yeah.
If you're listening to this one in the future, that's fine. You can drop us a line on that one. It's all good. But yeah, anything else you want to quickly mention, Captain?
No, I feel that we covered a lot of ground. So,
excellent.
Yeah.
Well, then I'll just close out by saying that Music A to Z podcast is hosted by Stephen and Doug Ferguson and is produced by me, Stephen Ferguson. You should check out our other works at nshgfilms.com, dougjcferguson.com, and stephengcferguson.ca.